Okay, so there's been a lot of interest at IX in measuring NFS performance on our products, and this is not something that I was very familiar with, so I had to learn some of these things, and so I'll just talk today about what I learned. So there's different ways to measure performance, and there's many tools and many scripts and many utilities, and I'm not an expert in this topic, but it seemed like every time I asked like 10 different people, how should I do this? They would say, you need to use this program, or did you use this program, or did you use this program? And even now, people tell me, are you using this program? It's used on Linux. So after a while, I said, well, all right, whatever. So let me pick one program and just figure out how that works and do that. So the program that I picked was SpecSFS. So Spec is there's a corporation called Standard Performance Evaluation Corporation, and it's a small corporation. I think they're in Virginia, and they make software for benchmarking certain types of systems. So they have like benchmarks for CPUs, benchmarks for Java VMs, benchmarks for NFS. And so the NFS benchmark is this one, SpecSFS. And so this one, it can do NFS and also SIFS. And so basically what I did is, so what you gotta do is you have to pay for this benchmark. So you pay these guys some money. If you're like a company, it's something like $1,000. If you're an organization or a nonprofit, they have a cheaper rate. But you buy the software from them, and they have source code in C, source code in Java, and binaries for Linux, FreeBSD, and Windows. But it's like the binaries are like for an older version of FreeBSD. So what I did is Garrett Cooper, who used to work at IX, had originally set this up on like an older test bed. But what I did is I updated this to a newer test bed, newer version of FreeBSD, and I ended up recompiling the binaries for FreeBSD 9. And so what I did then is I said, okay, well, I don't want to remember how to do this stuff, so I made a port for this. So there's a port in FreeBSD ports, it's a benchmarks SpecSFS. So the thing is that this port doesn't work unless you have the spec ISO. So this is one of these, in ports you can do a funny thing where if the dist file is not downloadable, it will, like the port will fail. It'll say, hey, you gotta go and download this dist file from someplace and before you can build the port. So if you yourself go and buy this ISO from spec, and then you don't actually get an ISO, you get an actual CD. So once you get the CD, you need to rip the CD and then put the ISO in a certain directory and then build the port, and then you're good to go. So so there's some C component to this, and there's also Java. So this port has a dependency on the OpenJDK. So some of what I had to do moving from the older testbed that Garrett had, his testbed was running like FreeBSD 8, and I think he was using one of the older precompiled Java distributions, binary-only Java distributions. And so I moved it up to FreeBSD 9, I moved to the OpenJDK, and I recompiled the binaries, and miracle upon miracle, I actually got things to work. So So the idea is that once you have everything working, compiled and installed, what you do is you have a bunch of different client machines. And ideally, the client machines are set up identically. And the client machines are then pointed to a what this in spec terminology is called system under test, SUT. And then what you have to do then is you have to make a config file for spec. And so the config file looks like this. It's just a big honking text file with a lot of different parameters. And you just fill them out. So like and you can actually, the manual for spec SFS is online. So you can read all this stuff. But I read a lot of this stuff, but I got a lot of help from my coworker, Alexander Moten, who some of you may have seen in different, he's not presenting anything, but you might have seen him around at BSDCAN. But he explained a lot about what these parameters are. And basically, some of the parameters that are interesting are this load. So this is in IOP. So 500 means 500 IOPs. So then what these parameters are saying is you start the load at 500 IOPs, and then you run one test. Then the number of tests you run is 10. And then when you go from test 1 to test 2, the test 1 will be 500 IOPs, and then test 2 will be 700 IOPs. Test 3 will be 900 IOPS. So that's what that load and incremental load is. Then in this clients thing, you can specify which are the clients. So in this case, I just have one client. But in other tests that I've run, I've had five clients or six clients. And how this spec test works, it's a distributed test. So what you do is you start it on one host, and then the program reads this config file and it says, oh, okay, I need to run on host 1, host 2, host 3, host 4, and host 5. So it will SSH to all the different hosts, and it will start test clients on all the hosts, and then they will direct the load to the system under test. And so then there's other parameters here, like you can say NFS, you can say SIFS, and then you can specify where the test results output go, and you can fiddle with block size and a lot of different things. A lot of these parameters I have never even played with, but you can tune these things. And so the idea, and then even the example config file specifies a lot of things. So then there's another config file where, let's see. So this config file is really long, but basically, this tells you, this is a weird way of specifying, this says the first field is the client machine, so my client machine was called spec9, and then the second parameter tells you the system under test, and then the NFS mount, so this is like the path to the NFS mount. And then you put the same mount point a number of times, and then that number is specified by this, I think it's this parameter, prox. So there's this funny algorithm which goes on where you can say these are the clients, that are going to be used in the test. This is the system under test, so the clients are going to access the server and do the load. And then you can say for each client, there's going to be this number of processes. So you can start 32 processes per client, and then each client is going to basically access the same that mount point this number of times. So this is how you can generate distributed load. And so when you generate 500 IOPS, the server that you start, it goes to all the clients and then it figures out, okay, we have five clients and they're going to mount this number of things. So I know each client has to generate this load, and then the overall load is going to be 500. So just understanding this test took me a long time. And even then, I don't understand everything. And I'm glad I didn't have to write this test. Yeah.
Did all 32 have to be directed to the same place? Or did
list no, they don't. They can be to different places. You could do it to different places. But just for my sanity, I made it go to one place. Because primarily what I've been doing is testing ZFS. So we have on FreeNAS or TrueNAS, a ZFS volume. Then you make a data set. Then you NFS export that data set. And then you run this guy on that data set. And so you gather results that way. And so the way how this test works also, which is interesting, is that you ask for 500, and then you either get 500 or you don't. So some tests are like, go and hammer on this thing and tell me how much this thing gives you until it falls over. But this is like, how much do you want? You want 500? Okay, I'll either give you 500 or not. But it doesn't tell you, can I do 10,000 or 100,000 or whatever. So part of what I've had to do is like run this test many, many times with different parameters and see, you know, how the system performs. And with since I'm mostly focused on ZFS, there's a lot of things with ZFS that you can tune. So like one example is in ZFS, the default compression, like in the newer versions of ZFS, we have LZ4, and that compression performs better. And it actually is noticeable when you are doing like a lot of, measurements against, with spec or even other things, because there's different layers involved. Because this is a network test, you know, all the stuff on the system is important, all the I/O and all the disk stuff, that's important. But then you have the network layers above it, you know, even things like RPC communication over NFS. And so Alexander's not here. But basically what we did is we ran this test many, many times, and then Alexander ran this test many, many times, and he's like Mr. Kernel Storage Guru. So he would run this test and then he'd say, I think that we should do like this, or I think we should do like this. And he actually, if any of you monitor commits to FreeBSD, like since probably between October and now, he's committed a lot of things to FreeBSD in various areas directly as a result of running this test many, many times and saying, oh, I think I should like do this. So like he's played with things like with the RPC, there's like this security thing. Is it TCP wrappers or something like that with the RPC bind? So in FreeBSD current, he's actually turned that off. And so if you want that on, you have to actually use a flag. So I think there's a new flag he added, because he said this is like a security thing that was added in the 1980s for RPC. It's like, it's useless. And it for this test generates a lot of RPC traffic. And so, you know, maybe it's not a real world thing, but it's kind of useless, because these days people use firewalls and stuff for security. So you don't need to use like TCP wrappers, things like that. The other thing that he did a lot of work on was the memory allocation in ZFS. There was something called like a special zone in the UMA memory allocator. And so some work was started to have a special UMA memory region, or whatever the terminology is, for ZFS. But that work was never finished. And so he completed that work. And that helped a lot too. And so he's done quite a lot of things. Because for that kind of thing, to some extent, it really doesn't matter what tool you use to measure, as long as you use the same tool. And you measure on system that's roughly the same, and then you do it again and again and again and again. And so this tool is pretty nice. It allows you to do a lot of things. So then when you finish the test, you get a config file that looks like so you get a config file that looks something like this. So this tells you, number of processes, requested load, runtime, number of files created, files accessed, and then it breaks it down by NFS operation. So you can see get adder, set adder, look up, read, write, create, remove, and then the aggregate things. So it's pretty nice. And then, so this is like the human readable output. Then the other file it gives a summary file. So this file looks like this. So it's just a column of values. And what annoys me about this thing is that they don't include the headers of each column. So I can never remember what this stuff is, so I always have to look it up. But when and the other annoying thing is that these are space delimited values. So it's like, what are you gonna do with this? I mean, make it comma delimited so I can import it into a spreadsheet. And so basically, I always import it into a spreadsheet, and then I put the column headings here, because I can never. I'm like, come on, put the column headings in there, but they didn't do that. So it looks something like this. So you have requested IOPS, achieved IOPS, average response time per operation, total operation, test time, protocol, TCP, IP version. Test file, load generator, SFS version. So you can theoretically run NFS over UDP. So if you do that, it will reflect here. But I mean, who in this day and age does NFS over UDP? I mean, no one, hopefully no one who is sane, so. So then what I've been doing is, so I mentioned in that configuration file, you start at 500, so that's one test. Then the next test is 700, then the next test is 900. So, you specify each test. So in this test, I went from 500 to 2300. And so, you can see in the lower ranges, it meets it, and then in the higher ranges, it doesn't keep up. And so, this is a way to tell, okay, this is, where, things are not meeting up. So this gives you like, what did I ask for and what did I get in terms of IOPS? And then it also gives you like the latency per IOP. And so you see at lower requested IOPS, latency is low, then as you're getting higher and the system cannot keep up, latency starts to shoot up. And so, that that's basically what I learned about spec. So that's like my summer vacation story, what I learned on my summer vacation. So there's a lot of other, huh?
What are the licensing terms? For example, I pay them $1,000 and then it's mine to run on.
So the idea behind spec is what vendors do is you can run this stuff and you can do like whatever you want internally. But the idea is that people like to publish results. So if you want to publish the results of spec, there's some rule, like you run the test, but then there's rules about what are the parameters you can put in that config file, and also the test system that you use, there's rules about how you tell the spec people what is the system you use, how did you configure it, what was the, you know, the CPU, the RAM, what NICs you used, what interconnects. And then, so there's like a table on the spec site where like each vendor puts their, you know, what product they had and the throughput and the protocol and all this stuff. So this is what they do. And then, so the idea is that by having a impartial third party test suite, then everyone runs the same test and then gives this result to spec, and then spec puts it on their web page. Then theoretically any customer can go and look at this and say, oh, okay, all right, then I'm gonna go with this guy's thing because his number is better than this other guy's number. So that's how it works. But you know, of course, benchmarking is like, you know, there's science and voodoo and lies and combination of all these things, but you know, a lot of people, especially in the lower end NAS market, they don't even publish numbers because what's the point? So, but in the higher end people, like probably Peter can relay information about like NetApp and higher end. They still do this stuff. So you'll see like EMC, NetApp, Hitachi have things like this here. So in terms of the software, I don't remember what the license is of the software itself, but most people really don't care about the software itself per se. It's not like they're gonna, you know, give it to their customers and stuff. It's the reporting and the results that people care about more. And you know, there are different tools for doing file system testing, NAS testing, NFS testing, SIFS testing. I just picked this one and started using it, and it seemed okay. So any questions? Yeah.
Do you also use this for your SIFS testing?
I have not. So the thing that is very interesting about this test, which maybe I didn't explain, is that they implement the NFS protocol in the software itself. So they don't use the host systems like RPC implementation to do NFS calls. And I believe they do the same for SIFS. And so there's some good and bad things about that. The bad thing about that is that, like, for SIFS, you really want to use Windows implementation, honestly. Because for SIFS, like, Windows is the dominant client. And, like, there's a lot of differences between each version of Windows, like XP and whatever server, Windows 8, the enterprise server. So in a Windows world, you really want to measure against the Windows stack. So I haven't really used the SIFS part of spec so much. And even on Mac OS X, you know, each version of OS X, like in the older versions, I think they use Samba, and newer versions, they use something else. So there's differences there. So you can use it, but I think a lot of people don't really pay attention to the spec part of, the SIPS part of spec, so. Okay, well, I think my time slot is done.
Hey. Hi, guys. So I'm Bjorn Sepp. I'm currently doing research in Cambridge. But what I'm going to talk about has not much to do with my own research, apart from that it's FreeBSD networking involved. I'm also not here as any representative of the NetFPGA team. As a matter of fact, they don't know that I'm talking about that stuff here. So this is mostly about things I've learned while using the platform and eventually decided, hey, let's make this available to FreeBSD users as well. So what is NetFPGA? NetFPGA is basically network cards with FPGAs on it that you can control, program yourself. They have open source hardware, software stuff, as in they have the Verilog available for you so you can modify it. They also have some software to run on top, and they mostly use it for research and teaching. There are about, 2,500, 3,000 cards out there in universities and probably a bit more that we don't know of. Well, I hope you know that. So this is the old card they've had for ages. It's the 1G card. It has 4x 1G. It has a bit of SRAM on board. It has DRAM, the PCI and JTAG stuff. And I've, to my best knowledge, never used it. I've seen the boxes with them, but some of you might say, hey, this sounds familiar to me, and indeed. But 4 or 5 years ago, Wojciech did a FreeBSD driver for this and did a couple of presentations, but the driver never made it into the tree. And once I'm done with my stuff, I might look at this again because, as said, there are 2,500 cards or something out there. He basically had some presentations, some more details about FPGAs and things, and the driver on his website, but he also created a couple of wiki pages, which are since then unmaintained, and I'm going to update them. The FPGA one might be interested in if you are not interested in that FPGA. It links to the Xilinx one, but you should also watch out for a bit of Altera coming, which I'll probably do over the summer. About Xilinx, I'll talk a bit more in NetFPGA anyway. So they have a 10G card these days. They've got 4 SFP plus slots, so you can put 10G or 1G SFPs in there. It has a older generation Xilinx Vertex 5 on it. Again, SRAM, 27 megabytes or something, 288 megabytes of DRAM, they have an RS-232 and a couple of high-speed interconnects left that you can use for whatever you want. My understanding is if you get the card, it's a card and it does nothing. It's all up to you what you want to do with it. And I've just told you that part. So in order to do something with it, you need, I'll let you come in. You'll want the Xilinx toolchain in there on an older version, mostly because the new Vivado stuff doesn't work with the old Vertex anymore they have. The primary development platform is Linux, and it's GNU make Python's KP for the test framework, and the Verilog and everything is in Git. So this is basically what you need, and this is basically what we need to get running on FreeBSD. So a bit about the journey. You download the 32-bit ISE from Xilinx website. However you get this, how you get the license is up to you. I can't help you with that. And you enable the Linuxer later and think, yeah, let's get it running. The first thing you'll find is it crashes on you and you have no idea why. And the answer is you need linprocfs, otherwise it'll just go boom. And obviously you need the Linux-based packages and stuff. So they ship with a nice couple of scripts to test your setup and then to test your framework environment and then to run the setup. And I didn't want to patch the script, so I just pretend, oh, I'm a 32-bit Linux, and run it. And it's an X installer, and it looks like this. Which button do I need to press? Okay, so it turns out you need a couple of more packages than Wojciech had initially documented, and things have changed since. So you need fonts and everything. And then I had the problem that the installer was standing there and saying 95%. And it was standing there for an hour, for 2 hours, and I pressed Control C eventually and killed it. And it turned out it didn't like my 12-core server in the Linux later with the Java they started and whatever. It was just hanging, so I booted with SMP disabled. And I've since tried with a 4-core, which worked. I need to find the sweet spot and document it, but it's basically a Linux Java they ship with their entire toolchain, and we run it on Linux or later. So yeah, you get what you get. So eventually, install completes, and obviously it thinks it goes to opt Xilinx, which is nice. It's one you get one directory, it's self-contained, it's really clean. But that op Xilinx is, for us, compat Linux op Xilinx, because we run it on Linux later, it's a Linux binary, so the installation goes into compat Linux op Xilinx. And you need to adjust the paths in their shell scripts later, just to make sure you get the stuff. And once you have the toolchain, well, you have a native board, and what you want to do is you want to put a bit file on it and see if it works, and you have a nice little external box which has USB on one side, JTAG on the other, and their tools are Linux tools that do USB. The good news is Xilinx has listened to the community in 2008 and they started using libUSB. And Wojciech, for the one she had done a libUSB port thingy for the Linux side, so he compiled it on Linux and had it lying around, but it didn't really work anymore. Other people have tried. Apparently our INTRI libUSB was supposed to just compile if you set a couple of options. That was a complete fail for me, so I talked to Wojciech and I started debugging his in January, and then it started to program it and failed, and it didn't work, but someone showed up on the mailing list doing a Linux later work and said, hey, I've got this libUSB package and stuff, and after a couple of updates, it just started to work. So we now have a package you install and you plug the thingy in and you can talk to it. And to program it, I use a program that's called fxload. There's some stuff Xilinx ships, but no one seems to use it at all. Mostly from a time before all this worked, a German guy reverse engineered most of the stuff for parallel ports for USB and wrote the tool, it's in ports. What you need is a defd change. So the moment you plug the shiny box in to USB, you get a defd notification. It runs the tool and it programs a bit of firmware into the box so you can talk to the board later. And obviously the stuff Wojciech had done 5 years ago was outdated and needed updating, not only for the Xilinx path, and there's a PR out there. LibUSB, I told you, and then Impact is the Xilinx tool you run under Linux or later, and it just programs your board. So that works out of the box. Now, so the next step is, hey, I've got a board, I can do something with it, but it's the default stuff they gave me. So you want to do something with the Verilog they give you, you want to change it, you want to do some research, whatever. And you basically, for the 10G stuff, you register with them, you get access to their GitHub repository, you check it out, and you type gmake because you're clever enough, because you know they do Linux, and you don't get very far. There's a lot of bin bash stuff in there, things. Mostly things that need to be more portable, and I've spent 2 weeks or something just going through all of them that I could find and tried to build. One thing that annoys me is, in the end, I had to patch the make files for Xilinx provided pcores, because they have a make clean in their make files at the end of the build. Now, what happens if you run make clean out of a make file? You get our BSD make, and obviously that doesn't really understand their make file, so you replace it with make and your gmake will do the right thing. So why I'm interested in this? I've been involved with a master's course which one of my supervisors is running, so basically they get an interesting project. And on the other hand, I've been involved with a research project that tried to get FreeBSD running with an experimental CPU on that platform. And I figured, hey, I have all the exports around. I have used it myself now. It's all Linux. Why not make it available for research on FreeBSD as well? And there goes your time. So what do they give you these days? They have the classic 1G repository, which I don't know much about. There's a NetFPGA 10G or public repository, which has a couple of reference designs I'll tell you in a minute. And there's an open source network tester, which we released last week, and I'll say something more about that. So reference designs they ship, and that you just get and can adjust as you want them. They have a couple of tests, and this is basically stuff you want to run once you get your board, put it into the machine, and make sure everything is fine, your hardware works. Then they have reference NICs for both the 1G and the 10G, and this is very simple NICs, as in there is absolutely no offloading in them. They have a one slot DMA engine, I think, and yeah, you can do packets, but don't expect much of that. It's basically, keep it in mind, it's a research platform, so you want other people to work on this and do their stuff with it. They have a switch design, and the light version of it, the normal switch uses a CAM from Xilinx, the light version I think doesn't. The reference router is an IPv4 router, and I'll say something more about it. And then from various students, you've got projects online as well that you can use. The reference router they use for their master's course, and what they basically do is, you get an input arbiter, you get the output queues, and they remove the middle. And then they tell you, you need to do those steps, we want to see all those, and you start parsing Ethernet headers, parsing IP headers, doing lookups for the forwarding information base, doing up lookups in one team for the hardware in Verilog, and you have a software team that does all the same stuff in software and programs the hardware, and they run a stripped down version of OSPF, and then they put the cards together and the various projects into interoperability testing and stuff. And that's basically a 10-week, 12-week course, and in the end they are going off and build their own feature, like you could do tunneling, you could do cryptography stuff on it, whatever you want. The other stuff they have released last week, which might be more interesting to some people, is the open source network tester. I've not seen it yet, but they have a nice YouTube video on their website, which is osnt.org, and it basically allows you to do something, what's the commercial product like an Ixia or something, you can basically give it a pickup file and it will replay it. And you have various parameters to tune it, say how often to replay it, at what speeds to send the packets out, do a bit of pacing and stuff. And they have a monitor on the other side too, so you can see what you receive. As much as I know, there is one problem at the moment that you can only do it a bit of more than 20 gig. So you can do line rate on two ports, but they said they just used one memory bank at the moment and that's going to be fixed. So you will get the full 40 or 4x10G out of it soon with the next update at one point. And that might be interesting. The entire Verilog and everything for this is available. The software in user space is available so you can adjust it to your needs and do what you want. The more researchy project I've been involved with was putting an experimental CPU on this board, and you might have seen a very simple PIO driver which basically talks to a small FIFO and sends packets in and out of FreeBSD that I committed a while ago. And basically what you have is you get the card, you have it in PCI on your host, and you have your four ports, and a good chunk of the area you have is an ARM, a MIPS, or whatever CPU that runs FreeBSD. So this is FreeBSD on the FPGA. And you can either talk to hardware, or at least in our case, soon also via DMA out here. So you get a good couple of mix of whatever you want to do from inside here or from the host. And I said, hey, if I have FreeBSD in here, I also want FreeBSD out here. I do not have that yet. The reason is I wanted to go on a plane on Monday to come here and it didn't finish anymore. But you can imagine what you want to do with these things. I don't know what they will do with them, or I won't tell you. So what works on FreeBSD, the driver for whatever you call these programmable socks would work, and if you take a Xilinx ARM core or something, you could probably just use it as well. I've got the toolchain as much as I've tested, including the graphical user interfaces Xilinx provides, running on FreeBSD. I'm building all the reference designs, the P-cores and stuff, that all works. The programming, the bit file works. And most of the stuff, unfortunately, currently still sits in my Git repository, but will be pushed to the main one once I'm back. And as I just said, the host driver is not entirely finished yet. I've not used their testing framework, which is a Python scapey thing. And the wiki pages will get all the documentation updated, like step-by-step guides, how to program this, how to do it yourself. In addition to that, NetFPGA has a lot of documentation on how to do it if you can read through the Linux bar and just think how you would do that. And that's basically from me, and I guess a couple of you have questions.
So what's the availability of the hardware?
The hardware is, to my knowledge, available. You can order it from NetFPGA.org website has the links to the vendors who provide it. I think for academic institutions, the 10G platform is like $1,500 or something. But don't quote me on that. The 1G is probably a lot cheaper, but I've not seen it. That's a licensing question. I can't answer. I think you free as in the Webpack stuff. Think most of the things you could possibly just get. The one thing you need is the license for the 10G core stuff for the interfaces. I think that's not available by default. So if you go on and download the 30-day trial version, you can't build the entire Verilog because that's this one thing that is missing. Yeah?
A couple of questions. First one, do you know roughly what the power draw of the card is when it's, say, running in that configuration? You've got your LibScore on it running?
No. I know they had a, so the one thing I've heard, and given they have the machines and I've never been exposed to this, is it's a Gen 2 PCI and they had a couple of problems with finding compatible motherboards, but don't ask me for the reason. It's apparently a problem some graphic cards had as well.
PCI
Gen 3 stuff.
Yeah, PCI Express?
Yeah, no. Yeah, yeah, 8-lane stuff, yeah, PCIe. Sure.
And just a question about the Berry stuff.
Yeah.
So you're actually burning the CPU into the FPGA and then you're running FreeBSD kernel on the CPU on the NetFPGA? Is that?
That's something you can do, yes.
That's what,
so a couple of people might have seen Robert Watson or some other people running around with Altera boards last year, which is basically what they do. They have a MIPS implementation in BlueSpec, and they run it on an Altera FPGA, but you could do the same with them. NetFPGA these days.
You're running previously on the host and, I don't know, sending computational work to the NetFPGA. You're actually running the FreeBSD kernel on the NetFPGA as its own.
Yes.
Isolated.
Yeah, so you get a 50-100 megahertz CPU in there, basically, and run it on there. One of the problems with the current board is it's in Xilinx Vertex 5, so you don't have an enormous amount of space on that FPGA.
So it's just running with RAM disks? And
this is, well, initially when you do the bring up, you do memory disks, and then eventually you do NFS or something as well. But it doesn't have any storage. In the host, yeah. You can change the hardware, you can build a path for that. Like, as I said, we'll do them. So, initially when you start and just connect NF10 like to a physical port, you can still loop it back to a second card to talk to the host over networking, even if you don't have the DMA. But yeah, you can do whatever you want over that interface, basically, if you write the driver and the Verilog. So, yeah, you can, if you have FreeBSD on the inside and the outside, you can imagine you can migrate things between stuff and do whatever you want.
So this is all very impressive. What's your use case? Why are you doing this?
I'm not doing this. As I said, like, the FreeBSD stuff is something I did because I wanted to have it on FreeBSD.
Okay.
It's other people working on these things.
The tools on FreeBSD, that's all great. I mean, this thing.
This stuff?
Yeah. Why?
Don't ask me, ask them. I assume you'll see publication eventually, but yeah. I mean, I can tell you why they are doing the experimental CPU on the Altera platform, but that's more for security research than for networking research. But you can imagine, eventually you want to talk to the world and do all this stuff there as well, so you put it on networking.
How long does it take to put a firmware out to one of these things?
Pardon?
How long does it take to write a firmware or to program the FPGA with the CPU and the FreeBSD bits?
As in, how long does it take to build the CPU, or how long does it take to build the bit file?
Yeah, so once you say go program the NetFPGA with all of that stuff.
30 seconds over the USB blaster thingy. My understanding is you can also, once you have the driver, you can program it over PCI, so you only need the USB side. You would theoretically only need once, put the bit file into flash, and then once you're running, you can reprogram it over PCI. But at least the very first time you get the card, you need the USB and the JTAG to program it. But assume you would put some of those cards in a server and want to do something with it, then you could actually update the bit files from the host without the USB parts. There's a bit of, like, if you're writing the driver and if you're reprogramming the bit file, you need to be careful to save your PCI state and restore it afterwards and make sure you do this right. And they don't always do it on the Linux side, and you get an oops and they continue and they wonder why the stuff doesn't really work anymore. So you end up with reboots, but
are there other reference? That, as apart from the experimental MIPS stuff that Cambridge is building, can you just get a
people so for the newer stuff, Xilinx stuff ships ARM cores. Like, what's the small FPGA board we support with the Xilinx on it, with an ARM core on it? We support some of those by default. It's some ARM stuff. Yeah.
Microblades.
No. SEC board or something.
You mean a soft core or a hard core?
Yes.
Yeah.
So there's a GSoC project previously to microblades that Xilinx is a soft core.
Mm-hmm.
It's only just the.
Is that coming?
Oh, I have no idea.
I've seen the proposal. I don't know if he accepted it.
I think it was. It's one of the
cool projects. So, yeah.
So for the longest time, I've been thinking about ways to do TOE, like full TCP offload, but still maintain control over the TCP stack.
Right.
The network stack. So
if you write the Verilog bits for this, you get your own implementation. But as I said, the default stuff, the reference design that comes with it, is basically a simple NIC and nothing else.
Right.
So you can extend it to whatever you want.
Soft core, but we could boot the kernel on and then have some way to pass from the host system, offload connections onto this thing.
Yeah, though, remember, this is a mid-late 90s CPU.
It
does not have the bandwidth on the bus. The 8 lanes are not enough for
full 40.
Gen 2x8 won't do
40.
Gen 2x8
won't do 40 gig, no. But so I think this is basically what they do with the network tester. You upload a bit file, a PCAP file, and they parse it, and then you give it all the parameters to tell it how often to send it out and stuff, because over the bus it's not possible.
How much RAM's on the
car? 288 RLD RAM MEC, and then 27 MEC of SRAM, yeah.
What's an RLD then?
Think of DRAM, slow memory.